Welcome to Down to Earth, Theology and Worldview for the Nooks and Crannies. I'm your host, Kelly Tarr. Here, we bring biblical theology down to earth and aim to build an increasingly consistent Christian worldview that fills the nooks and crannies of life, pushing it out to the edges. Jesus Christ is King over all of life. Scripture is sufficient for all of life, so the topics we tackle involve all of life. I'm glad you're here. Hey, listeners, before we jump into today's episode, I want to let you know that in 2 weeks, April 30th, I'm going to do a Q&A episode. So send me all your questions. They can be controversial. They can be curious. Do you want me to flesh out a particular topic of conversation more? Do you disagree with something I said and want me to clarify? Are there any particular topics or people you'd like to hear on the podcast? Or are you just curious about something? I want to hear from you. So send your questions to downtoearththeologypodcast@gmail.com, or you can send me a direct message on Twitter/X at KellyTarr2, which remember it's T-A-R-R, or on Instagram at Nooks and Crannies Worldview. So get them in by Monday, April 22nd. You have a week, giving you a week to work on your question asking skills. So I look forward to hearing from you. Now on to today's episode. Welcome back to Down to Earth, Theology and Worldview for the Nooks and Crannies. I am really looking forward to our conversation today because it falls right in line with something I believe is an absolute necessity as a Christian. We must deal with reality. We are living in increasingly hostile times, and as Christians, we can't be complacent or bury our head in the sand. We must face reality, and then we must live in it. My guest today, Aaron Wren, is helping Christians do this with his new book, Life in the Negative World, Confronting Challenges in an Anti-Christian Culture. If you haven't read it, I hope you'll be motivated by the end of our conversation to pick up a copy. I believe it's an important work that will help many Christians understand where we are in history and how to live accordingly. So Aaron, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
For listeners who aren't familiar with you or your work, can you share a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I grew up in rural southern Indiana, about 4 miles outside of a town of, 50-ish people. So I grew up in a very rural area, but it wasn't remote. It wasn't like I was hundreds of miles away from the nearest city. It was about 40 minutes from Louisville, Kentucky. So it was essentially metropolitan rural.
Okay.
You might call it that. Went to college and moved off to Chicago and essentially had three careers. Career number one was management consulting. I spent 15, 18 years in that field, mostly with a company called Accenture, which is still around today.
Okay.
And then I pivoted to urban policy. I got very interested in cities as a result of coming from the small town and living in Chicago. And it was really a transformative experience for me. And so I sort of just applied the consultant's hat to the problems of the city, started writing, became very, very popular. So I said, maybe there's a career there. And so it was a very complicated business, much more so than I anticipated, but ended up successfully pivoting into that and was a senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute in New York. It's a think tank there. And then I did another pivot into sort of writing about evangelical issues, but with an emphasis on men's issues. So about a decade ago, I saw all these young men were turning to online influencers instead of to the church. And I'm like, why is that? And if anything, it's only grown as these influencers like Jordan Peterson, et cetera, have exploded. And the church really hasn't figured out how to appeal to men. And so that was my entree into the field. And then I've expanded and sort of do a lot of, again, similar to consulting type analytical analysis of the evangelical world. And so I do a few things. You know, obviously I'm a writer, journalist on the topic of Christianity. I have my Substack at aaronwren.com. You should all sign up for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I do speaking and freelance journalism associated with that. I'm also a senior fellow at American Reformer, which is a Protestant-oriented nonprofit, which is trying to help, evangelicals successfully adapt to this new world we find ourselves in. Mm-hmm. And I also still do a bit of work here and there in kind of the urban and public policy space, kind of in the cult to conservative think tank world, mm-hmm. journalism world, things of that nature. So that's sort of what I'm doing today. I live in Indianapolis now, suburban Indianapolis. And obviously I The thing that I'm most delighted to tell you is that I wrote a book called Life in the Negative World, Confronting Challenges in an Anti-Christian Culture. And it's, people have been telling me for like 17 years now, Aaron, you need to write a book. I never did it. So I finally wrote a book.
Okay. So why didn't you write it before now? 17 years is a long time.
Well, it was originally about, originally they were saying this about cities. Okay. And there are a bunch of reasons. One, I didn't have a great idea for a book. A lot of the best ideas that work well for books take like one really simple idea and try to filter the whole world through that idea. And I never had an idea like that. And then I finally came up with an idea that's similar to that and entered it into a book. Secondly, I was never really sure. It takes like 2 years to write a book, basically, from coming up with it, selling it, writing it, getting it through the publication process. You're basically looking at 2 years. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to be doing a year from now, much less 2 years from now. I didn't feel like I had enough stability in my life to take on a project like that. But, you know, then, you know, I eventually reached that point. And they've said sometimes there are two kinds of people in terms of writers. There's sort of book people and magazine people. I'm more of a magazine person. You're more remembered if you're a book person. So that's why it's good to write some books. I said, I'm glad I wrote this book. And maybe I'll write more. I don't know, but I'm glad I wrote this one.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very thankful for it. And you should write more. But we'll just see, you know, what the Lord allows. So first of all, do you have kids? Married?
Yeah, I'm married and I have a son, 6-year-old son.
Okay.
So, and, you know, I had him when I was late. I was 47 years old when he was born.
Okay.
So, but it's great.
Yeah.
Better late than never, I would
say. That's right. That's right. My youngest is 6, about to be 7. So it's a really fun age because they're starting to read and just exploring a lot. So, okay. Well, thank you for the excellent work that you did do with this book. I am very glad that you wrote it. One thing I really appreciate about your writing, not just in your book, but on your Substack, is that you're very straightforward, you're very clear, and you're very practical in your writing. And in the introduction of your book, you say that it's intended to be useful and practical rather than ivory tower academic or scholarly. And I think that you accomplished that. So I've mentioned to you before we got on, but my husband and I have read your Substack for a few years now, and it's the same. It's the same way, which is why people should subscribe, and we can put the link in the show notes. So you put out excellent writing, but you also don't shy away from boldly speaking the truth, and you equip at the same time. So that really leaves a reader like me hopeful, but also with practical takeaways, things to think about and things to do. So I thoroughly enjoyed reading your book, and I also thoroughly marked it up. That's my usual.
Well, good.
So I know there's not going to be enough time to talk through everything I'd like to, but we're going to give it a go and just see how far we get. But people can read your, hopefully it will leave them wanting to buy your book. So I want to dive in. Unless you have anything else you want to throw.
No, go ahead.
Okay. So in your introduction, you explain that the book is about the shift to the negative world, what that means, and how to live in that reality. But before getting into the specifics of the negative world, I think the best place to start, just in case people are like, what is a negative world? I think the best place to start would be for you to explain your three worlds model to our listeners. So what is it, and why do you think it's helpful for Christians today?
Sure. So we never had a state church like they did in Europe. But for much of American history, we had most of American history. We had a sort of softly institutionalized generic Protestantism as our default national religion. So as recently as the 1950s, half of all adults attended church every Sunday. We had prayer and Bible reading in public schools. We were adding In God We Trust to our money, Under God to the Pledge of Allegiance, things of that nature. And then in the 1960s, this started to unravel, and Christianity went into decline in America, a decline that continues to the present day. And I divide this period of decline from 1964, say, to the present, into three eras or worlds that I call the positive world, the neutral world, and the negative world. The positive world lasts from 1964 to 1994. And this was a period of decline for Christianity, to be clear. All is not going well for Christianity, and yet it's still basically viewed positively in society. To be known as a good church-going man like makes you seem like an upstanding member of society, makes people maybe want to hire you, vote for you. Christian moral norms are still the basic moral norms of society, and if you violate them, you could get in trouble. Around 1994, we hit a tipping point and entered what I call the neutral world, which lasted from 1994 to 2014. And in the neutral world, Christianity is no longer seen positively, but it's not really seen negatively yet either. It's just one more lifestyle choice among many in a sort of pluralistic public square. And Christian morality has a sort of residual effect. Then in 2014, we hit a second tipping point and enter what I call the negative world, where for the first time in the 400-year history of America, official elite culture is now negative towards Christianity, or certainly at least skeptical. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's a difference there we could talk about. To be known as a Bible-believing Christian does not help you get a job in the elite domains of society. Quite the opposite, in fact. Mm-hmm. Christian morality of a traditional variety is expressly repudiated and is now viewed as the leading threat to the new public moral order. And so that is a very dislocating place for American evangelicals who are used to thinking themselves as the quote-unquote moral majority to find themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So after you explain the three worlds framework in the first section of your book, which is called Welcome to the Negative World, you explain the strategies that Christians employed while in the positive and neutral worlds as culture warring, seeker sensitivity, and cultural engagement. But then you go on to say that, tell your readers that these same strategies will not work in the negative world. So why is that the case?
Well, basically, evangelicalism, as we understand it today, is actually a product of this period of decline in American Christianity. If you go back to the 1950s, it was really the mainline Protestant denominations that sort of dominated the country. Mm-hmm. But as Christianity went into decline, mainline Christianity went into decline, and it never recovered. I mean, they've never figured out how to turn it around.
Right, right.
And evangelicalism sort of filled the void. It was able to adapt better to changing times and changing culture. Mm-hmm. And so it really sort of blew up in the 70s and the 80s and, of course, became what we had today. So, you know, in a sense, evangelicalism's success at adapting to a period of decline helped keep Christianity alive and vibrant in America in a way that it did not stay in, say, Europe. Where it kind of fell to nothing. So, and again, along the way, there were these different strategies that people created. You know, the culture war in the 70s, you know, I think most people are familiar with the culture war, the religious right. You know, again, starting in the 70s, the seeker sensitivity movement, which is, you know, what today we would think of as the non-denominational suburban megachurch movement. Mm-hmm. And then in the 90s, in the neutral world, the creation of what I called culture engagement, which was essentially the urban church movement pioneered by people like Tim Keller. You could think of it as a seeker sensitivity for the cities or something like that, where they were now reaching this urban population in the way that the seeker sensitives reached the suburban population. And I make the point, I think all of these people got something right. They actually all got some important pieces of the puzzle correct, but because they were sort of specific adaptations to particular moments in time, even though they're all still with us and all still kind of alive and kicking, you know, they're not really going to be as effective.
Right.
You know, there's kind of going to be diminishing effectiveness of what they do over time. Mm-hmm. And so just as in the positive and the neutral world, we created these strategies, I think in the negative world, we also need to create new strategies.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that they have to have something that's completely different than what came before, because obviously the contents of Christianity haven't changed. You know, theology hasn't changed.
Right.
I think there is a lot to learn in terms of missional strategies from those people, but we need to understand how to put it into practice and contextualize it for the current era.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I think it's worth reading, if you don't mind, a section from the end of chapter 2, when you talk about cultural engagement, because you explain that you believe many of the culture engagers are the most at risk when transitioning into the negative world, because they've maintained a higher status amongst the elite in America, which is a place that the culture warriors never really had. So in other words, the culture engagers have been respected by the elites. And so you say, I'm going to read just a little bit, to adapt, some of those who live and work in these hostile environments have been turning away from cultural engagement in favor of an evolving synchronization with secular elite culture, particularly on matters such as race, immigration, and the Me Too movement, aligning more closely with progressive and political positions. At the same time, they further softened their stance and rhetoric on other traditionally evangelical flashpoint social issues. For example, they increasingly talk about being holistically pro-life, emphasizing aid to single mothers or support of immigration as pro-life positions rather than just opposition to abortion. And I'm skipping ahead, but you go on to say, in short, the cultural engagement strategy as one of relevance, sometimes with transformational emphases, has had to shift to try to remain relevant. It has also come to see secular movements, such as the present emphasis on racial justice, as vehicles for cultural transformation. The net result has been a syncretistic approach. And I'm going to keep going for just a second. You go on to say that the culture warriors can survive in a diminished sort of way, but the future of culture engagers and megachurch people who have turned toward cultural synchronization, however, looks grimmer. The much discussed failures of the evangelical elite can't be understood without reference to the way the ground rapidly and fundamentally shifted under them when the transition with the transition to the negative world. Their desire to remain relevant in secular elite society, their social gospel type transformational focus, and the embrace of current secular academic theories are reminiscent of what happened to the mainline denominations, though this time the secular theories are from the social rather than natural sciences. Those denominations, once well attended and socially prestigious, have lost a large share of their members over the last 50 years. And those who remain in the pews skew elderly. The theology in some of these congregations is but a thin veneer of on top of secular progressivism. The results could easily be the same for cultural engagement evangelicals, retention of cultural cachet for a time, but ultimately the slow loss of adherence and theological orthodoxy. And my first thought when I read that was, wow. But I also think that I think you do a good job of explaining that. And I think that you offer a lot of charity in that also by talking about how quickly the ground changed underneath. So I don't know if you want to comment on that, but I have two reasons for bringing that up. So you comment first and then I'll share why I bring it up.
Sure. So, you know, one of the things is I have a foot in different parts of the evangelical world. You know, I was raised in a rural Assemblies of God church that was very much end times, culture war, you know, Pat Robertson, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then as an adult, you know, I've lived in big cities, Chicago, New York City, and been a Presbyterian, mm-hmm. you know, for much of that time, a Presbyterian today. And so I also I feel like I understand a little bit about both of those.
Right.
And I feel like I understand the kind of psychology of the striver. You know, you come from the small town, you move to the big city, mm-hmm. you're trying to make it. Like making it is like a big part of the psychology of people who are sort of doing those sorts of things. And so, you know, when I see that I'm in the city. And when I write about cultural engagers, you know, I'm in a sense writing about people who share my basic outlook on life in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And they're just in a very different environment. I mean, if you live in Chicago or New York, you know, it's in a very different environment than like where I live today in suburban Indianapolis. Suburban Indianapolis, most people still seem to go to church. It's a very mm-hmm. religion kind of friendly environment. You know, where I grew up is fine. You know, there you get a lot of people who work in media. They work on Wall Street. They work in the arts, you know, they're in legal professions, they're in tech, and, you know, they're in sort of high pressure environments, the kind of places where you don't have to be religious, but you could, you know, you get canceled there all the time. It's like, you know, you say, you say people of color instead of BIPOC, and the next thing you know, you're fired.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't upgrade your software fast enough. And so, you know, maybe that's a little bit of a facetious example, but the reality is that is their world. And so they're under enormous pressure.
Yeah.
And this also gets back to what I said earlier, that maybe a better way to think of it is that the world is skeptical rather than negative towards Christianity. What I mean by that is you will not get in trouble merely for identifying as a Christian, mm-hmm. although it may generate some initial suspicion.
Right.
You know, Raphael Warnock, who's a senator from Georgia, Democrat, is a pastor of a church. Nobody ever seems to call him a Christian nationalist. He doesn't get any flack for that. Yeah. You know, Pete Buttigieg, the Secretary of Transportation, You know, he says, I'm an Episcopalian. Mm. And they're like, nobody gives him a hard time, right?
Yeah.
The key is that the contents of your Christianity cannot materially conflict with kind of secular culture. So this puts immense pressure on people and creates a huge incentive structure to bring their theology sort of into compliance with this sort of secular world. Right. And so I think by and large, that has happened rhetorically, but not theologically. That is to say, many of these people have changed the way that they talk.
Okay.
They talk a lot about racial justice and immigrants and stuff like that. They talk a lot about that. They talk less about other things, but it hasn't necessarily changed, you know, what they would tell you they actually believe. Now, will that stay the case? I don't know. I certainly think they're, you know, they're doing some upgrading and downgrading of doctrines kind of as we speak.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that's sort of the situation they find themselves in. You know, you had a guy like Tim Keller who seemed to have cracked the code on relating to the secular elite. I mean, here's a guy who's, you know, getting invited to give Google talks, you know, and who gets nice New York Times profiles. You know, Nicholas Kristof wants to do a sit down with him. Then all of a sudden, he's just another fundamentalist. You know, it's just, he's just another bigot who doesn't have female elders in his church.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the world changed a lot, and the strategies that worked in this neutral world no longer work as well in the negative world. If your model is about engaging in the culture, but the culture won't let you engage, that's a challenge.
Yeah.
And so I do think they're in a particularly challenging situation. Much more, again, much more so than the culture warriors. A lot of the culture warriors, you know, if you're like a, you know, car repair technician in Southern Indiana where I grew up, you know, you can post anything you want on social media because it's not going to affect you. You know, so I do think a lot of the grief people give the big city Christians is not fully appreciative of the environment in which they find themselves.
So, Do you think that, would you say that right now, because we are still obviously adapting to the negative world, that there are people who are not adapting well and are compromising, or do you think it's too soon to tell, like as far as leaders go in the Christian world?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. I think we've seen a few things. One is we've seen this big trend towards deconstruction. And you cannot understand the deconstruction phenomenon apart from the shift to the negative world. Deconstruction is entirely a result of the shift to the negative world. You know, not to say that nobody would be abandoning the faith, but this idea of deconstruction and all of that, it's very much. That's one of the reactions. There's also been realignment. So you take a guy like David French. You know, 10 years ago, you would have said he was a hardcore culture warrior. Well, today he's a New York Times columnist and spends most of his time criticizing conservative American Christians.
Right.
And then lastly, we've seen sort of deformation. And so I, you know, where I think these sort of doubling down on strategies, I think there has, I do believe there has been a change in beliefs, but on what I call marginal areas or like ancillary areas, not what I call core doctrine, which is to say, you know, one of the examples is the culture warriors. When Bill Clinton, you know, was involved in the Lewinsky scandal, they would have said character is everything.
Right.
If you don't have the requisite character to be elected president, nothing else matters. Well, of course, then these people all vote for Donald Trump and they regularly actually defend Donald Trump, even though he's a man of manifestly low character in so many ways. And so I think, that you could call that hypocrisy. You could call that, you know, whatever. But certainly that's a change from the past, no doubt. Now, I do think that there will be more. I do see there's a lot of sort of things brewing. I think one of them is going to be around gender theology, you know, particularly whether church, you know, is, you know, can churches have female pastors and elders, you know, are husbands the head of the home? That's, for a lot of people, been treated as a sort of, you know, pretty important issue. not as important as the resurrection of Christ, but it's sort of been a boundary issue. So right. for some of these groups, like these new Calvinist organizations, like the Gospel Coalition, you had to basically affirm that what they call a complementarian theology mm-hmm. in order to be part of that. Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of definitely disintegrating. So I think there's definitely a move afoot by a lot of people to basically push that down from like maybe a secondary to a tertiary issue mm-hmm. and say, oh, it's no big deal if people disagree on that.
Right.
I think they're going to do similar things on sexuality. They're simply going to de facto, what these rhetorical techniques allow you to do is say, look, yeah, I personally believe in complementarianism, but it's, you know, if everybody else is egalitarian, that's great. They're perfectly fine. It allows them to sort of take these positions that allows them to, you know, affirm something while de facto, you know, adopting the other side in terms of practice.
Right.
And of course, we can see this is somewhat opportunistic because they certainly don't operate that way when it comes to things like your position on race, where they become much harder core
right.
On certain things, even though the Bible says less about race than it does about gender
right.
and other things. So that's what I kind of see happening, there. It's playing out, I think, differently than the mainline churches, because a lot of the mainline churches had a liberal theology, mm-hmm. which with liberal theology, basically, you know, they rejected inerrancy of scripture and things right. like that.
Right.
And so they would say, yeah, you know, we don't believe in historicity and miracles, the virgin birth or any of that stuff. And so for them, it was quite straightforward to simply adjust their views with changing times. In fact, they kind of viewed that as in line with their own way of thinking about
right,
scriptures.
Right.
Whereas evangelicalism with this highly biblicist approach, this, inerrancy doctrines, you know, to really call yourself an evangelical, you have to essentially affirm that what the Bible teaches is true.
Right.
And therefore you have a text, you know, when you have a text that's, you know, that says something, you actually have to come up with I actually think it's more dishonest, to be quite honest. You have to do some kind of mental and rhetorical gymnastics to, argue that somehow it means the exact opposite of what it says, you know, mm-hmm. Paul writes, you know, don't allow a woman to have authority over man, something like that.
Right.
You know, a mainline person would probably say, first off, First Timothy wasn't even written by Paul.
Right.
These weren't even written by Paul in the first place. These are written in like the second or third century by somebody else. Oh, by the way, Paul, you know, was a product of his era, and that was just, you know, cultural. And, you know, Paul was just wrong. Okay. Mm-hmm. On that, you know, Paul got some things wrong mm-hmm. and that, you know, they can say some variation to that. Whereas if you're an evangelical, you can't say that, but what you have to say is, well, what specifically is being talked about here? And so they get it, and then they do a whole lot of like slicing and dicing in the Greek and trying to create a bunch of doubts and uncertainty about what it means, so that nobody can really be absolutely sure about what that's talking about. And therefore, you know, it does whatever it means. We can't be certain, but we know it doesn't mean that women can't be pastors today.
Right.
And so, you know, something like that, you know,
right, right.
So they have to affirm that the thing says what it says, that Paul wrote it, that's authoritative, but they have to come up with some bizarre way of talking about it. And maybe the most famous of this is, in Ephesians 5, where it says the husband is the head of the wife or something like that.
Right.
As Christ is head of the church. They took the Greek word, translated ahead, kephale, I think is how you pronounce it. And they made these arguments. They did, you know, well, actually the word kephale doesn't mean head is in authority. It means head is in the source, headwaters of a river. It means source. It doesn't denote authority. It doesn't commit. You know?
Right.
So like they actually, that's the sort of thing that they end up having to do. And so I think kind of doctrinal evolution in evangelicalism looks different mm-hmm. than it did in mainline Protestantism mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. precisely because they have to sort of affirm the text of the Bible,
right?
You know, unlike the Catholic Church, where they have to, you know, the Catholic Church has to believe that all of its previous official proclamations are also accurate. Mm-hmm. So they have to actually, you know, it's not so much the Bible, but like the Fourth Lateran Council and all that stuff. Well, that's mm-hmm, got to mm-hmm. be true, We can't roll back the Council of Trent. That's not allowed. You can't ever roll anything back.
Yeah.
But we have to figure out how to roll it forward. So every kind of denomination has its own way that it does doctrinal evolution, depending on how, you know, what their different boundary markers are. And so I definitely think you're going to see a lot of, you know, what it's almost sophistry, you know, as people make these arguments about what the Bible, quote unquote, really says.
Right. And I don't want to jump too far ahead, and we might not get to it anyway, but this, would you say that this is what leads to the delegitimization of the church when it comes to speaking on things such as gender?
Well, I don't know if it's this per se.
Just the method that you're talking about, like having to, you know, the Bible says this, but what it really means, because there ends up being an inconsistency.
Well, I don't think that's the issue, that it's credible to the world. I think part of the issue is evangelicals have become excessively biblicist. It's like one of the phrases of the day is biblicist. The idea is we can't appeal to anything but the Bible. And therefore, if you want to make an argument, the only argument you can make has to be rooted in some scripture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the real problem is this: the Bible doesn't talk about a whole slew of things.
Right.
And so, you know, you end up with things like Icus dating by and stuff like that. The purity culture, they tried to like shoehorn some of this stuff into scripture.
Right.
And it actually led people astray because they thought his dating advice was actually from scripture.
Right.
Instead of, you know, I think the Catholics with their natural law tradition have a much better way of thinking about it. You know, for example, the idea that we can look at the anthropology of what it means to be man and woman and, you know, how we see it, you know, them in the world and draw any conclusions from that. Like evangelicals would basically just puke on that.
Right.
And so the reality is we spend all of our time arguing about extremely narrow points of scripture and find ourselves completely unable to speak on anything else. And so I think this over dependence on the Bible as the sole source upon which you argue everything is a problem. You know, obviously the Bible is the sole source of information of all things necessary for salvation.
Right.
You know, I don't think we certainly can't impute, you know, the gospel from the natural law or from anything else. But the problem is like, there's a whole slew of human, you know, experience that we don't actually have authoritative biblical pronunciations on. Dating. The Bible says nothing about dating. How do you find a spouse?
Right.
There's nothing in the Bible about that. So we struggle in situations like that. It's like, okay, great. You want to learn how to poach an egg? Get the joy of cooking. You know, that's what you need to get. You know, if you want to understand how to replace the fill valve in your toilet, go to YouTube and watch a video that gives you how to do that.
Right.
It's like, there's so much in the world that's like actually true. That's just not in the Bible. And I think when we treat the Bible not as the sole authoritative source of truth and the sole source of sort of most spiritual truth, we end up, we can't even really talk intelligently on most things.
Right.
And that's a problem. And part of that's because, you know, in fairness, pastors are supposed to exposit the Bible. Okay. And so it's good for a pastor to say, I'm going to stay in my lane and just talk about the Bible theology. But one of the things that like the Catholic Church has is a lot of Catholic, you know, laymen who can speak on topics like, you know, Patrick Deneen talking about politics. Mm-hmm. What's the kind of the, you know, one of the Catholic positions on politics, you know, look at what Patrick Deneen wrote and, you know, or secularism. How do we understand secularism? Let's look at Charles Taylor, who wrote the book of Secular Age. He's a Catholic philosopher. We have far fewer of those lay experts. And so that's one reason that a guy like Jordan Peterson runs rings around the church. You talk about Jordan Peterson, like, yeah, I have a PhD in psychology. Like I know this literature forward and backwards. I've done tons and tons of clinical counseling practice. I know what people are talking about. And, you know, I can speak to people in ways that are addressing their questions.
Right.
Whereas the church really doesn't have any way to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, so for example, I'll just give one example to contrast Jordan Peterson with the church. Men and women are different. I think the church typically affirms that. Mm-hmm. but they're very, very vague about what that means.
Right.
So what are some of the specific differences between men and women? They don't really tell you. I mean, occasionally they'll tell you that like men, there's something about men that's uniquely bad, you know, something like that, but right. you won't hear like this, but you know, Jordan Peterson will say, yeah, we have these things called the big five personality traits. And if you look at one of them, which is agreeableness, women store higher on agreeableness than men. So women are more agreeable than men. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he'll talk about the implications of that. I mean, and so like, you know, no pastor would ever say something like women are more agreeable than men on average. Mm-hmm. Because they can't point it at scripture. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, they'd actually have to invent some finding. They'd have to impute some finding from scripture if they wanted to say that.
Right.
So that's a long-winded way of talking about it. But I think that, you know, that is one of the biggest things that I think is a challenge mm-hmm. is, you know, the church doesn't seem to have answers to most of the world's questions because yeah. the answers to a lot of the world's questions are actually not found in the Bible.
Right. Right. So that leads, man, I really want to talk about the gender stuff because you've written a lot about it on your Substack. And that honestly, yeah. that is what, I mean, I enjoy reading your Substack, but my husband and I really enjoy talking through the stuff that you write okay. there. Because it's very astute. It's very helpful. But I think that also segues into the middle section of your book, parts 2 and part 3, which are really my favorite parts because I'm a very practical person and love discipleship. And I think that you do a really good job of equipping people. So I'm going to have to pick and choose what we talk about at this point. Okay. So I also believe that we are in need of reformation. So you also talk of the need of the hour being that we must evaluate ourselves and understand what time it is. So you say the first challenge for American evangelicals living in the negative world then is to examine ourselves, consider our ways, count the cost, and commit to denying ourselves, taking up our crosses and following Christ in everything. This must happen no matter what the price, confident that Jesus will never fail or forsake us, that all things will work together for our good, and that whatever suffering we do endure in this world is not worthy to be compared with the glory to be revealed in the age to come. So I really appreciate because you, at the beginning of your book, in humility, you say you're not a theologian. However, you don't shy away, like I said earlier, walking people through scripture with really good questions to ask themselves, such as how serious am I about doing what the Bible says? And you make it very clear that you say today's world allows people to be accepted while identifying as Christian if they bring their doctrine into alignment with the world's standards. This pull toward compromise to be culturally accepted creates a fertile environment for the abandonment of orthodoxy. So I'm going to digress for just a minute. But we need people like you. And this is what you were just talking about, Jordan Peterson. Okay. We need people, men like you, right. And we need women too. But so I'm thankful that you took the time to write this book. I don't like to talk about my own story publicly very much because parties are still living, but I feel like I have skin in the game when it comes to this because I don't remember if I mentioned it earlier, but I didn't grow up in the South. I grew up in the DC metro area, which has been very secular for a long time. And I was also saved out of an unbelieving family, and it was very costly at that time with my family. So it's been a bit of a challenge for me to live in the South because my background in that regard is foreign to a lot of people here. I'm thankful there's a lot of cultural Christianity here. And my husband actually did have to talk me through it because at one time I was not thankful for it, but I am now because I understand. So when I've talked about some of the similar issues that you do in your book, I've gotten into a little bit of trouble and it's often rejected, like in this area of the country, probably not the whole South, but just the immediate context that I'm in. So the realities of the negative world. So I was saved in the late 90s, so it was still neutral world. However, I wonder what you would say. I'm sure across different areas of the country, it's taken time. Like down here, the negative world is here, but I don't think it's felt as much yet as it is in other areas. So I think that your exhortations in this section of the chapter and the questions that you ask are really needed. So, but what I also appreciate is that you don't leave your readers there. You're not dumping all these things on them. Like you need to be thinking about this and you need to do this. You offer hope and you offer very practical help as to how to begin thinking. So in sections 2 and 3, you start laying out practical strategies and you say, you know, I'm not going to tell individuals or churches exactly what you should do, but here are ways to start thinking. And you hone in on personal lives and also institutionally. So personally, you want us to be obedient, excellent, and resilient. So if you would, I'd love for you to walk us through this. And why did you choose those three characteristics to hone in on?
Well, again, one thing I didn't want to do is give people, a 50-point to-do list or something. Right. It would be too overwhelming. So I said, I only have like a handful of things I can talk about.
Right.
And maybe I even gave too many, even in the book.
I don't think so.
One, it was just, you know, ideas that I had. You know, I ended up saying, well, I'm going to give three ideas in three different areas. Yeah. So I sort of picked that.
Yeah.
The obedience is just the passage you just read, where I've been very inspired by the Sermon on the Mount, in which Jesus closes the Sermon on the Mount with the story of the person who built his house on the rock and the person who built his house on the sand. Mm-hmm. And what was the difference between the two? And he says, the person who built this house on the rock is the person who heard my word and actually did it, put it into practice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's just given this Sermon on the Mount. And the idea is, like, you actually have to do this stuff.
Right.
And you have to live this way. Whereas the person who puts his house on the sand is the one who heard him, but he didn't do it. He didn't put it into practice.
Right.
And so that's, I think, where we are. And again, it wasn't until the flood came that we found out what their foundation was. Mm-hmm. And so I really think, will we have a flood in America? I don't know. But we've got storm clouds on the horizon in ways we've never had before.
Right.
And so I think people need to take stock of where their foundation was. So that was one thing there. The excellence, you know, I'm an intellectually oriented person and, struck by the famous book Mark Knoll wrote, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, which is, again, what I'm just saying, why is Jordan Peterson running rings around us? It's because he's actually smart and he knows what he's talking about.
Right.
And we just don't have those people in so many domains. And, I'm trying to engage on those areas where I am, but we really need a movement for evangelical excellence, and that's to say we do have areas where we're really good. You know, we have a lot of great preachers. You know, we have some great evangelical businessmen. We really do. We're really good at business. There's a lot of other areas where we're not as good. Cultural, intellectual domains. And then the other point I just make is that, you know, the world's harder today. There are more ways to fundamentally ruin your life today, you know, than in the past. In the past, right. Yes, you know, there were things that could have happened that would have, you know, really wrecked your life, but they didn't happen to very many people, right? It was contained in a sense. And all of the old stigmas and guardrails and things like that sort of kept people on the track. Well, now, like getting involved, like when I was a kid, you know, let's say I wanted to become an opioid addict or a meth addict when I was a kid. First off, I didn't even know what those were. Right. And secondly, they weren't available.
Right.
You know, if somebody said, Aaron, you want to try some heroin? Like, where would I get heroin? Now in rural Indiana, hard drugs are everywhere.
Yep.
So there's more way, you know, there's availability. Now you have gambling on your phone, sports gambling on your phone. Mm-hmm. You got so many things there. And the truth is, like that old blue collar economy that like you could graduate from high school and get a decent job and get married and have a family. It doesn't work that way anymore. It's a lot harder. Right. Things are just harder in life.
Yeah.
And when it's harder, we have to elevate our game.
Yeah.
So that was one. And then of course, resiliency, you know, if you might get a hate mob come after you, then you need to think about, you know, building a life that's resilient to that. Mm-hmm. So those were some of the things that, again, in part, it's just because those were three thoughts that I had.
Yeah. No, I think those are great. And I think that, so with the resiliency, I think that's where you talk about real world risk, understanding it, and then learning how to live in it. And that's one of those things where, again, depending on which area of the country that you're in, it may seem like, oh, you know, I live in small town America. That's none of those things could happen to me. But the reality is, and I think that you do a good job of helping people understand this, we don't live there anymore. Like because of social media, because of the online world, any person, you know, you say one wrong thing online and, you know, you could be done in. I mean, I'm not trying to sound like over the top, but I think that you I want people to hear and I want people to listen because we are there, you know, we are in negative world. So I really, really appreciated that section. And I don't know which one I would say is my favorite, but the be excellent one, maybe, because I think that we really need to grow there as believers. But then,
well, I agree.
Yeah. So in part three, leading institutionally, you talk about institutional integrity, community strength, and ownership. And there's so much we could talk about there, but I wanted to hone in on a few different things in your chapter on community strength. And this is where you really talk about how we need to be thinking as moral minorities. You point out four areas where we can focus on strengthening. You talk about education, equipping, not insulating, counter catechesis, and repairing our sexual economy. So would you talk to us about this? One, I don't think that we've talked yet about, you know, having to shift our thinking to being the moral minority, but also why did you choose these four things?
Yeah, well, I mean, first off, this chapter hasn't generated enough controversy yet. I'm kind of surprised because
we can do it today.
One of my big arguments is like, look, you know, fundamentally, here's what, maybe I should have more explicitly stated this and I will do it going forward. Now that we live in a negative world, mm-hmm. society is negative towards Christianity. Now that we know we are a minority and yes. the world does not support our positions,
right.
then what should we do? Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I say we should do is we should be much more concerned about how we are living.
Yes.
And much less concerned about how everybody else is living.
Yes.
You know, I mean, and I, again, I didn't put this in the book because it's kind of theological. When I read Paul's epistles. And one time I went through all of Paul's epistles and I wrote down every command that he gave people.
Yeah.
And I tried to say, okay, what categories are they? So I divided them in a bunch of categories. Mm-hmm. And overwhelmingly, they were divided into two categories. One was personal holiness and the other is unity in the church. Mm. There were surprisingly few commands that Paul gave to any having to do with anything outside of the church. Mm-hmm. And what he did was mostly about how to accommodate yourself to it with the least amount of disruption.
Right.
So, you know, pay taxes to whom taxes is due. So far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men.
Right.
You know, and you go look at Ephesians, you know, he's dealing with a situation where there's been some outrageous sexual sin in the church. He says, those who are outside, God judges.
Right.
You get rid of the sinner from your own midst. And right. I think that is really something that's something we should be adopting much more. Mm-hmm. Not that we should be indifferent to the world, but we should be much more concerned about what's going on in the church. And frankly, the church is screwed up.
Right.
in a lot of ways. And yeah. There seems to be this assumption that it's the world who's messed up and we've right. got the truth. I think there's way more reforms needed in the church
yes.
than people want to give credit for.
Right.
And so like I say, repairing our sexual economy, that means, okay, great. All right. You know, are we getting rid of porn in the churches? Are we, having good, healthy family formation? Are our divorce rates low? Are we, having and raising kids well? Like, having them at all. There's a lot of work to do there. Not yeah. that we're all bad. Maybe we're even better than the world, but we're not that great.
Right.
And so I feel like there's a lot of work to do on that point.
Yeah. And the reality is that, and I think that you even say this, is that we cannot give what we don't have. So
right.
if we are trying, if we want to see revival in our culture, or if we want to see name any number of things, less crime or, less sexual immorality, whatever, we've got to look at ourselves first.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think we ought to be much, much more concerned about what we're doing.
Right.
And a lot less concerned, again, about what other people are doing.
Right, right.
That's my thing. I mean, evangelicals are constantly harping on this, that, or the other thing. I'm like, well, why don't we take a look at, what's in our own eye
right.
for a change? And so, this idea of, strengthening community and thinking like a moral minority is saying, okay, great. It's like we live in a foreign country where we're the minority culture. And we're going to let them do their thing, but we're going to be much more concerned about our own community.
Right.
And so thinking about, you know, how does this affect us? What's, you know, what should we be doing? That should be, we should be much more focused on that.
Yeah.
I would say.
And the reality is, well, there's two things here. One, when Paul is writing, that's who he's primarily writing to, people who are living in exile, people who are the minority, right? And also, before we can export something, we need to get really good at it ourselves. And so it's really hard to export things that we are clearly failing at doing, right?
Right. Well, and it's hard. That's why Paul had to write all these letters.
Yes.
Because people are screwing up.
Right.
And, you know, that's, it's hard. Like, you know, one of the things that I really take away from his letters is about, you know, salvation is again, not just about the individual going to heaven when he dies.
Right.
You know, but there is a great concern over the inauguration of this new community, the church, mm-hmm. you know, and so much of, you know, the latter half of latter parts of Romans, the second half of Ephesians, a lot of First Corinthians. It's like, how do we live together as the church?
Right.
That's a big focus. And yeah. like, you know, we're not really focused on that too much at all, to be right. quite honest.
Right.
And so, I mean, again, I don't want to overstate things, but like, we've got a lot of work to do. And when we're always fired up about some outrage on the internet,
right.
you know, we're not dealing with that.
So are you saying you want an X on your back? Is that why you want this to be more controversial?
Yeah, well, I just feel like, you know, if people understood what I'm basically saying, I thought they would be more, you know, more pushback against that.
Right.
Because it, you know, like Paul says, do good to all men, but especially to the household of the mm-hmm, faith. Mm-hmm. The idea that we would prioritize other Christians and saying, okay, we're gonna put our efforts in helping others and in community towards other people of the church.
Right.
I'm surprised more people wouldn't say, you know, we shouldn't do that.
Well, maybe once they fully understand what you mean.
Yeah. Well, maybe I need to be more aggressive. I haven't gotten enough pushback yet.
Well, real quick before moving on, one thing I want to point out is when you're talking about the equipping and not insulating and the counter catechesis, you know, I grew up in the nine, I'm 43. So a little younger than you, but not too much younger than you. But you know, at that time it was enough to, and I didn't grow up in a Christian family. So I'm just making a statement that I think is true. When you talk about this, you know, there can be discipleship that happens, but now how we need to parent is not just by passing on information. It's never just passing on information, but you make the point that with the counter catechesis, we need to teach them what not to believe, you know, and how not to think, because it's so in their faces. And the reality is that, you know, if we aren't teaching them how to think, somebody else is, because even just, you know, my husband and I have talked a lot about how it's so different now. Our oldest is going to be 17 soon. And, you know, I did not get a cell phone until I went away to college. And all that I had was like an emergency phone. I didn't even really know how to operate it. My dad gave it to me. I went to school 8 hours away. So just in case I needed to called them or had an emergency, that's what it was for. You know, I didn't get a smartphone till like within the last decade, maybe eight years ago. I don't know. And so it's completely foreign. You know, we're having to talk to our kids about things that, you know, we never even had to think about before. Right. So I don't know if you want to speak to any of that, but I think that's a really, really important point. And I don't know that we've transitioned to understanding yet. I think that what we're finding is through our failure, oh, we actually need to be doing this, you know? And I don't know that that's necessarily, it is a bad thing, but I mean, it's not necessary. It's not that we're doing it on purpose. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I just think, you know, part of it is like the counter catechesis is like the idea here is, you know, when the world's culture, official culture, and everything that society says is something that you don't believe with or agree with.
Right.
Then you have to explicitly cover off that with your kids.
Right.
An example I use is like Jews in America. Okay. At some point they have to explain to their children what Christmas is and why they don't celebrate it.
Right.
And that's what we have to do. It's like, here's what they believe. Here's why we don't believe. Here's what we believe. Here's why we don't believe.
Right.
What they believe. Right. And, You know, so that's one thing. And again, the smartphone is a good example of what I mean by equipping, not isolating. So, you know, it used to be like, oh, we got to like listen to Christian music. We can't have any rock. Like when I was a kid, like no rock and roll music. We're not going to listen to rock and roll music.
Right.
Well, you know, with like smartphone, you know, there's just like, I think people realize now, okay, great. Smartphones can be bad for kids. So let's not give our kids a smartphone. And it's some, I think there's a, you know, kids do get phones way too young.
Right.
And so there is a point in like not introducing it to them.
Right.
But this idea that is, well, I just won't give my kids a phone ever. Then they turn 18 and yep. they leave
yep.
and they're going to get a phone.
That's right.
And you've done nothing to equip them for how to use a phone properly.
Right.
And so that's the point is like, you can't just say, I'm going to isolate people from the phone.
Right.
Because you're not going to be able to isolate them. You know, certainly not for the rest of their life. You have right. to equip them to live in a world where everybody has a phone.
Right.
Everybody's got an iPhone.
Yep.
And, you know, here's how you have to learn how to use that technology wisely.
Right.
At least give them something to yeah. get them started. And right. and so that's where I like this idea that, like, again, we can't just isolate people. Again, I'm not saying, you know, you give your two-year-old the phone. But at some point, it's like, okay, well, middle schoolers shouldn't have phones. Okay, well, when are they going to get a phone? Well, I'm never going to give them a phone. Mm-hmm. Well, they're going to get a phone at yeah. some point. And if all you did was raise them to not know how to deal with a phone, you know, then kind of shame on you.
Right. And it's, you end up sabotaging what you're trying to accomplish with your kids when you do that, you know, because if you're raising them in a strong believing home, but then you release them to the world with no preparation, what they're going to encounter is the real world. You know, there's going to be no filters on the real world when they leave. And so,
yep.
Okay. So real quick, I know we don't have very much time, but, in your last section, I'm looking back real quick. Okay. So in your last section, which is called Be a Light, I think that you encapsulate well that in many ways for such a time as this, we are alive. And as Christians, we are to be the light of the world, and we should have so much hope and help to offer people who are suffering. You mentioned that we can bring clarity and be a courageous voice of reason amid the morass that people recognize and are sick of, but maybe they can't put their finger on, you know, how to think exactly or how to navigate through it. So there's a tremendous opportunity for us to be about very good work with the Lord, but to be a light, to be a source of truth. And, you know, you mentioned being prudentially engaged socially and politically. Those things require the obedience, the excellence, the resilience
yep.
that you talk about, not to mention all the things you talk about in part three. So otherwise, you know, and you mentioned this, people will write us off. And they do, you know, they are turning to people like Jordan Peterson. They turn to secular psychology to help them figure out life's problems. You know, I don't want to repeat stuff on Jordan Peterson. You already talked about that, but this is where you argue that, and you said this earlier in our conversation, that this is a place where lay people who are well equipped and who are competent in their various giftings and strength can and need to step up and be a light and bring their experience and expertise to the table, complementing the work of pastor. So I don't know if you want to add anything else to that, but I think that that is huge. I think there's a huge opportunity right now. So for example, this is like the bazillionth time I've mentioned this on the podcast. Abigail Schreier just published her book, Bad Therapy. Okay. Lots of people are reading it. I've been reading it. I think one thing that's challenging for me, I do biblical counseling, and I think that there's a great need, say in the biblical counseling world, to continue to produce excellent material that can help people learn how to navigate, you know, a lot of the things that she talks about in her book and that people go to psychologists or, you know, other people helpers for are common to man problems. But if we are not competent, if we are not respectable, even and respected as being competent people, they're going to turn to those other things, you know? So yep. I would love to hear you talk about that more. If you have anything else, I know you talked about it a little bit already.
Yeah, there's some of that. I think, you know, part of it is, you know, we don't necessarily have, it's not easy to just conjure up a good PhD psychologist who's really good at like writing right. and speaking. But, you know, one of the things is we actually have a lot of ordinary people who are kind of living very healthy lives, but too often, you know, we're putting our light under a bushel.
Right.
And so I, you know, here's an example of that, you know, go back to the gender issue. There are plenty of people in the church who have very happy marriages and healthy marriages. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about that at all. Why don't we talk about that? Hey, you know, my marriage is great. We don't want to make anybody feel bad. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody's got a bad marriage. Somebody can't get married. Somebody's had, it's like, we constantly feel like we can't make people feel bad. Mm-hmm. And so as a result, we're sort of hiding a lot of the good things that we have. It's even been noted sort of in secular society. I've seen articles written, like op-eds, like, hey, I have a happy marriage. Why is it taboo to talk about that? Yeah. It's like all my friends, all they want to do is get together and complain about their spouses.
Right.
Like, what about those of us who are happily married? It's almost like there's a taboo against talking about that.
Right.
And so I feel like there is a sense in which, like, we don't actually like let our light shine in terms of what we've created and let people see and invite people into to our lives to get a picture of that.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like we're hiding. It's, you know, this guy, Rob Henderson, he's a writer on the internet. He just wrote a new book called Troubled, which looks great. I haven't read it yet, but I've read a lot of his stuff. He's talked about his life. He talks about when he was at Yale, you know, he came from like a really troubled background, working class, went to Yale. And he's like noticing all these people who look so shabby and poor, but they're actually like trust fund kids. They're wealthy, but they all adopt this posture of being poor.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have any money. I'm like, I'm just like, and, you know, that's, so I think there is something where like people are sort of like, you know, disguising things. There's a lot of weird stuff there. I don't pretend to know it all, but I feel like, although I think we need to make sure that we welcome, you know, although we need to make sure that, for example, that we welcome people who are single and, you know, make them feel included. We should not say that, like, well, you know, it's a, you know, that marriage is not the normative path for men and women, because it is. I mean, that's the norm. And this is reality. And we shouldn't be ashamed of that. And I think in reality is we're kind of ashamed of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, because, you know, the truth might make somebody feel bad.
Right. And it's like that across the board. So I don't remember if it's in this section or earlier on, you talk about how we need to be courageous. And if the world, you know, has a problem with it or they don't like it, it doesn't matter. You know, we need to be obedient and then we need to speak the truth and we need to do it courageously, because the reality is, you've written about this, older single women aren't happy most of the time. Right. Yep. I mean, it's like, it might not be okay for me to say that, but when we lie to people, you know, whether that be with, you know, affirming the gender stuff, like the transgender stuff, or whether it be singleness or whatever, we're not really loving them and we're not really helping them, you know? And I do think that we end up in the end losing relevance because, you know, we aren't doing what the Lord has called us to do ultimately.
Yep.
And so, so I appreciate that. I would really like to talk about the gender stuff more, but maybe that could be a whole nother episode, because I think that you've done a lot of excellent work. That might be what, you know, gets you into the most trouble if we were to keep talking.
Yeah, I thought that chapter might too. But, you know, I actually did a lot of work to try to make the book as non-controversial.
Yeah.
I mean, the point, you know, it actually helps you sell copies to have big controversy. But I wanted, you know, and I do this in my writing. I spend a lot of effort to be able to say things that are bold, but to say them in a way that people can take in.
Yes.
And I'm not trying to just throw bombs at people.
Right.
You know, because that's what sells, but that's not how I want to conduct myself.
Well, and I think you've done a great job. And I just, you know, I just listened yesterday to another podcast episode where Timon Klein, who he helps or runs American Reformer. Is that correct?
Timon, he's the editor of the publication.
Okay. So he and another, I don't remember his name, were on another podcast episode where they were talking about some of the implications of your book. And so I think that the way that you've written it, it allows for that, you know, allows for reasonable dialogue to happen instead of just people, because what ends up happening sometimes with more controversial things, and it's not necessarily bad to write controversial things. I think sometimes it's really needed, but I think sometimes what ends up happening is you end up talking past each other and you don't get much accomplished. I think that what you've done is going to allow people to have intelligent, reasonable conversations and be productive. And so,
well, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, it's super encouraging, because I think that the time that we're living in now, I think that we tend to do one of two things. We either want to deny reality or it's doom and gloom, you know, and there's not usually a lot of in between.
Right.
And so I appreciate your optimistic, positive perspective on what the future could be. And so listeners, I do hope that you'll pick up the book because it's worth the read. And you know, you showed me an area where I need to grow my intelligence. You pronounced catechesis when I was pronouncing it.
Well,
the wrong
however
way.
You pronounce it, maybe it is pronounced your way. To be quite honest, I don't necessarily know how to pronounce all these words. You know, I think of catechisms like a Catholic thing. I grew up in grew up very low church, so we didn't have any of this stuff.
Yeah, no.
So don't assume that I know how to pronounce words because
I think you are saying it the right way though.
You know, the thing is because I mispronounce a lot of words, but that's okay.
Yeah. Well, one more thing real quick. Speaking of that, is that I think given the worlds that you have worked in, some of the more elite areas of society, say, I think that you do a really good job. And I think this is who you are. You are a very down to earth person. And that definitely comes through in your writing. So
no, thank you.
So I think that you're taking big ideas. I think that could be very ethereal. Right. And you're bringing them down to earth, which I like because, it's the name of my podcast. But so thank you so much for your time. And I do hope you'll come back at some point. I would love to talk more. Love to talk about gender stuff. You know, we could talk about other things. Mm-hmm. But where can people find you if they want to learn more?
Sure. Go to aaronren.com, www.aaronren.com. Sign up for my newsletter. The vast majority of it's free. And so, all the stuff that I write elsewhere, I consolidate into there so you can find it. Okay. That's the best way to get it. Everybody should do that.
Yes, everybody should. We've been reading for a long time. And I've actually, when it was called The Masculinist, you probably don't remember this because you have so many people, but I responded to one of the emails and I was like, I might be one of the only women reading this, but I really appreciate it. I'm learning a lot. Yeah. So thank you for your time. And listeners, I hope that you will find Aaron online, that you will go and follow him, get the book. And if you do, I'd love to hear from you. So thank you for listening in today. And until next time. Thank you for listening to our episode of Down to Earth, Theology and Worldview for the Nooks and Crannies today. Be sure to check out the show notes for any links or resources we mentioned. If you enjoy this episode, please share it with your friends and leave a rating and review. Your time to do this helps get our content to more people. You can find more information about the podcast or listen to previous episodes by going to kellytarr.com/downtoearth. A special thank you to Johnny Nance, the producer of Down to Earth, without whom this wouldn't be possible. See you next time.